The headlines: several children are killed in fresh Israeli strikes on Rafah amid threats of a ground invasion of the southern Gaza city that hosts displaced Palestinians. The UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees warns that a man-made famine is tightening its grip on Gaza as Israel continues to block aid into the besieged strip. Then Hamas hails Iran's punitive operation against Israel as a legitimate and deserved response to the regime's attack on the Iranian embassy in Damascus. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half hour: Israel's indiscriminate strikes, which have been ongoing for well over 6 months, continue to claim more Palestinian lives across the besieged Gaza Strip. In one of the latest attacks, 7 civilians, including a woman and 3 children, were killed after a residential structure sheltering displaced people was targeted in the southern city of Rafah. 13 others were killed after Israel bombed a group of citizens near the Sheikh Radwan Bridge in Gaza City. Separately, Palestinian rescue workers recovered the bodies of 11 Palestinians from under the rubble in various areas in Khan Yunis. Gaza's health ministry says the death toll from the Israeli genocide has risen to nearly 33,900. Over 76,600 others have been injured. The World Health Organization has renewed its call for protection of Gaza's hospitals, which have been a regular target for the regime's attacks. The WHO described the destruction inflicted on Gaza's hospitals as heartbreaking. Israel has admitted that over 7,200 of its soldiers have been injured since October the 7th. Our correspondent in the central city of Deir al-Bala, Moti Abu Mostab, updated us on the latest massacre of Palestinians by Israeli forces in various parts of the besieged strip.
Yes, actually, the Israeli occupation forces continued their attacks against Gaza Strip. Several airstrikes actually hit different areas of Gaza Strip, basically in Rafah City, whereas the Israeli occupation forces committed an appalling massacre against the Palestinian civilians there after the Israeli war planes targeted a room which was taking shelter by a family from Gaza. That family actually was displaced from Gaza City to the Rafah City, as you know, to the southern part of Gaza Strip. At least 11 Palestinian civilians, including 3 children, were massacred over that attack in Al Junaina neighborhood located in the southern part of Rafah City. In the meantime, the Israeli war planes also renewed their airstrikes against the southern part of the city. Those areas adjacent to the Egyptian border were hit relentlessly by several Israeli airstrikes. In the meantime, the Israeli war planes also carried out several airstrikes against the eastern part of the city. Another residential building was destroyed in the eastern part of Rafah City. Moving to Khan Yunis City, more Palestinian dead bodies were extracted over the last night. At least 11 Palestinian corpses were extracted from the rubble of the destroyed houses. In the central area of Gaza Strip, here in Deir al-Balah City, the Israeli occupation forces actually killed another Palestinian civilian in the eastern part of the city after the Israeli snipers opened their gunfire towards the Palestinian people there. When it comes to Gaza City, the Israeli occupation forces also committed another crime after targeting a school which was taking shelter by the displaced Palestinians. At least 2 Palestinians were reportedly killed, while dozens were injured over that attack. While these moments, as we speak right now, the Israeli artillery maintains its shelling towards the eastern and the southern part of Gaza City.
Residents in Gaza share ordeals they're going through amid incessant Israeli airstrikes and shelling across the besieged territory. Let's take a listen.
Every second there is death. Death threatens every human in Gaza, in Rafah, in Khan Yunis, wherever they are. Threatens every human. Death follows them. Before, we used to say that death was near. It affects the young, the elderly. But today, we live in a different reality. We live in a reality where every minute, every second, even during this interview, a rocket can fall and hit us. This has become a normal thing. The people and the whole world got used to our death. It has become normal. There are 3 killed in Gaza, 20 died, 35 died. It has become something normal. We became numbers. Don't get upset, and no one should get upset by what I am saying. We became numbers. I swear to God, numbers.
What happened is that they were at home, safe. A father, a mother, 3 girls, a boy was with them. They were staying at home. They were obviously displaced. They were staying at a relative's house from Abu Hanif family. Suddenly a rocket fell on them around 11 o'clock or just before. It dismembered them. They all died. The boy, the 3 girls, the mother, the father with their grandmother.
I woke up to the noise. I heard the noise. I woke up to the sounds of the girls calling, Mom, Mom. And they were screaming and little ones were screaming. I got up running and saw the children running. We started tripping over the mortars, over heads, legs, bodies, all of which were scattered in the shop and here. There's blood on the chair and blood here. Also the old woman there, our neighbor.
The head of the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees warns that a man-made famine is tightening its grip on Gaza as Israel continues to block aid into the besieged strip and seeks to end UNRWA's activities.
Children are bearing the brunt of this war. More than 17,000 are separated from their families, left to face the horror of Gaza alone. Children are killed, injured, and starved, deprived of any physical or psychological safety. Across Gaza, a man-made famine is tightening its grip. In the north, infant and young children have begun to die of malnutrition and dehydration. Across the border, food and clean water wait. But UNRWA is denied permission to deliver this aid and save lives. This outrage is occurring despite consecutive order by the International Court of Justice to increase the flow of aid into Gaza, which can be done if there is sufficient political will. You have the power to make the difference. UNRWA's mandate is supported by an overwhelmingly majority of member states. Yet the agency is under enormous strain. It is facing a campaign to push it out of the occupied Palestinian territory. The agency's requests to deliver aid to the north are repeatedly denied. Our staff are barred from coordination meetings between Israel and humanitarian actors. Walls, UNRWA premises and staff have been targeted since the beginning of the war. 178 UNRWA personnel have been killed.
Lazzarini also said that its members who had been detained were tortured in Israeli custody, with some of them being stripped naked, among other forms of abuse. The agency says several detainees were also subjected to insults and humiliation, such as deprivation of water, food, sleep, and toilets. In some cases, they were made to act like animals and were urinated on. UNRWA said in other cases the detainees were threatened with prolonged detention, injury, or the killing of their family members. Israel has a history of mistreatment of detainees, as some UN rapporteurs in the past had documented Israeli abuse of Palestinians held in jails. The resistance movement Hamas has called the torture of Palestinians affirmation of the regime's brutality and war crimes in Gaza. The UN Security Council is set to vote on the Palestinians' bid to become a full member of the United Nations, according to diplomatic sources. The vote is expected on Thursday or Friday. Malta, which holds the rotating presidency of the 15-member council, has yet to confirm this schedule. Currently, Palestine has a permanent observer status at the world body. It sent a letter earlier this month requesting for permanent membership at the UN. The request, which amounts to the recognition of Palestine as a state, must first pass through the Security Council before being endorsed by the General Assembly. The resolution needs at least 9 votes in favor and no vetoes by the US, Britain, France, Russia, or China. Informed sources say the resolution has the support of 13 members, but the US, a key backer of the Israeli regime, is likely to veto the move. Iran's foreign minister says that he will discuss the West Asia security in the Gaza ceasefire with his counterparts on the sidelines of the UN Security Council meetings in New York.
Due to the fact that the situation in Gaza has reached a boiling point and this situation is spilling over to the region, an opportunity as a reason to explain the views of the Islamic Republic in line with the necessity of establishing sustainable peace and security in the region. We have an opportunity to discuss the issue with other foreign ministers, UN Secretary General, as well as senior officials of international organizations. We will discuss immediate ceasefire in Gaza, delivery of humanitarian aid, and other issues related to Palestine, as well as the security of the region.
The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has hailed Iran's recent punitive operation against Israel as a legitimate and deserved response to the regime's attack on the Iranian embassy in Damascus. The movement said Iran's operation ended the era of Israel's impunity and accountability, and unaccountability, that is. Hamas also deplored Western countries' concerted action to defend Israel against Iran's punitive operation. It said Western states that defend Israel have remained totally silent on the regime's genocide in Gaza and repression of Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. The movement also reiterated its call on Arab and Muslim nations as well as regional resistance groups to continue supporting Palestinians in their struggle to liberate their occupied territories. News Review, where we look deeper into some of the top stories of the day. On this segment of the program, the European Union has decided to impose new sanctions on Iran's drone and missile programs under the pretext of Tehran's weekend retaliatory strikes on Israeli positions in the occupied territories. EU Chief Charles Michel says the leaders of the 27-nation bloc have agreed to come up with new anti-Iran sanctions. He did not specify the details, but claimed that the EU wanted to send a clear signal to Tehran. The bloc's move runs counter to its earlier statement urging the warring sides to exercise the utmost restraint and avoid any action that may escalate regional tensions. Iran launched an unprecedented strike on Israel in response to the regime's deadly attack on the country's embassy in Syria. Iranian officials have already criticized certain European states as well as the UN Security Council for their failure to denounce Israel for its aggression. Well, joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have academic broadcaster and investigative researcher David Miller joining us from Bristol. Also, we have spokesman of the LaRouche organization, Mr. Harley Schlanger, joining us from Potsdam, Germany. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Miller in Bristol. And first of all, I want to get your perspective on this recent decision by the EU regarding more sanctions on Iran.
Well, it's amusing, isn't it? I mean, this is the organization who, from a perspective of the UK, you would think that the EU was a body which would understand how markets and capitalism operates, having introduced a whole series of reforms to market mechanisms over the last two or three decades. But they appear not to have learned any of the lessons of their disastrous attempt to sanction Russia over Ukraine, which massively backfired on the EU, leading to massively increased energy prices, for example, in the EU countries. They appear not to understand that Iran produces these missiles and drones, including its ballistic missiles and the new hypersonic missiles which it has, by itself. It produces these natively in the country, despite the ongoing sanctions which there have been, which cause very many hardships to the Iranian people. And I saw myself when I visited Tehran last year. There are, of course, in the Museum of the Revolution of Holy Defense in Tehran, British military equipment which was previously sent to the Shah of Iran prior to the revolution. It's not the case now that the missiles made by the Iranian government are made using British or European components. They're made natively, and indeed if they weren't and there was a need for foreign components, they could be provided, not least of course by Iran's increasingly close partners in China and Russia. So this is a grandstanding and manifestly a ridiculous approach to sanctions, which attempts to sort of imitate the boycott against Israel, which does have a supply lines in the West and which can be influenced by Western boycotts.
Mr. Schlanger, your opinion on the issue as well. Do you agree with Mr. Miller in Bristol?
Well, my question is, where's the strong message from the European Union to Israel for its attack on sovereign Iranian territory in Syria and Damascus? Where is the condemnation of the genocide being committed in Gaza? What the European Union signaled is that it will continue to violate international law, or I should say support and sanction or allow the violation of international law by Israel and by other Western powers who continue to send more weapons into Ukraine. The same EU that issued this statement against Iran, these new sanctions, also issued full support for Ukraine. Now, in both cases, where is the international law? You talk about a rules-based order, and instead you're allowing and, in fact, complicit in genocide in Gaza and in Israeli strike in a sovereign territory, sovereign Iranian territory in Damascus. So it highlights, as Mr. Miller was saying, the hypocrisy of Western leaders, but also the foolishness, the idea that Israel is saying they will retaliate, and this is acceptable for these leaders. They say, well, do it humanely, as they've said in Gaza. What is humane about killing children? So I think what we're seeing is the absolute discrediting of Western institutions. And what is most upsetting is that there's still not a sharp enough outcry from American citizens, from the citizens of the European nations, against their government's complicity in these international law violations by Israel.
All right, thank you, gentlemen. Academic broadcaster and investigative researcher David Miller joining us from Bristol. And thanks to spokesman for the LaRouche organization, Mr. Harley Schlanger, joining us from Potsdam, Germany. Well, the Israeli army has conducted another airstrike on southern Lebanon, leaving two civilians dead in Kafr Kila village. For more details, we now cross over to our correspondent in the Lebanese capital, Beirut, Mayam Saleh, who's joining us now from the Lebanese capital. Mayam, what details do you have to share with us as Israel continues with this manner of behavior of attacking the southern Lebanon?
Well, we had some very heavy shelling on Kfar Kila and Khiyam late at midnight. The Israelis continued to bombard the two towns, especially Khiyam. We also know that they used phosphorus bombs, and there was all types of heavy shelling, bombardment, bombs that were used by the Israeli army against those two towns. Now, those incidents specifically came right after Hezbollah struck an Israeli unit in the settlement of Motille. Motille is just adjacent to those towns, Kfar Kila and Khiyam, and is usually the launching site of a lot of Israeli artillery towards the surrounding towns. We know that Hezbollah had the night before targeted a vehicle, a military vehicle, using anti-tank missiles or guided missiles, as we know. And then when another unit came early this morning to try to retrieve that military vehicle, Hezbollah targeted that unit. Hezbollah says they also scored direct hits against those soldiers, leaving scores of Israeli soldiers either killed or wounded. And so it seemed the Israelis wanted to respond by that attack. But we had a very significant attack that occurred yesterday by Hezbollah. It is by all means considered one of the most qualitative operations so far. Hezbollah has aired footage.
Thank you, Mayam Saleh, joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable Discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. Iranian missiles were able to evade the much-vaunted $1 billion Iron Dome anti-missile system. The drone and missile strikes were preceded by a cyber attack on the Zionist regime's electrical grid, shutting down power, thereby disabling its radar system. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Crescent International Roads, Islamic Republic of Iran's widely anticipated retaliatory strike against the Zionist regime was carried out on Saturday, April 13th, codenamed Operation True Promise. Hundreds of drones and missiles were fired at the Zionist entity. What was even more striking was that all drones and missiles were launched from Iran's own territory, the first time that such an attack has been carried out against the Zionist regime's targets. Iran had vowed to avenge the Zionist regime's attack on its diplomatic mission in Damascus. Seven Revolutionary Guard members, among them Brigadier General Mohammad Reza Zahedi, a senior commander of the IRGC's Quds Force, and his deputy, General Mohammad Hadi Haji Rahimi, were murdered. The April 1st Israeli regime strike was a clear violation of the Vienna Convention, under which diplomatic missions are fully protected. The fabricated regime of Israel has ratified the Vienna Convention. Thus, the Zionist regime's attack on Iran's diplomatic mission was an attack on Iranian territory. Iran's retaliatory strike was also in accord with Article 51 of the UN Charter that states that any state party against whom aggression is committed has the right to retaliate in self-defense. This is what Iran did against the Zionist regime. There are conflicting reports about the number of drones and missiles Iran launched against Israel. Iranian sources have reported between 400 to 500 drones and missiles launched against the Zionist entity. The Israeli sources say that there were about 350 drones and missiles fired at its territory, but that 99% of the threats against Israel were intercepted, according to Israeli Army spokesman Daniel Hagari. He conceded, however, that minor damage had occurred at the Nevatim Air Base in Beersheba, southern Israel. He added, 25 out of 30 cruise missiles were intercepted, and of the more than 120 ballistic missiles, only a few of them penetrated Israeli territory and landed at the Nevatim Air Base. Scott Reeder, a U.S. military expert and former UN weapons inspector, said on X, formerly Twitter, that at least 7 missiles had hit the Nevatim airbase. Now, none was intercepted. What this means is that Iranian missiles were able to evade the much-vaunted $1 billion Iron Dome anti-missile system. The drone and missile strikes were preceded by a cyber attack on the Zionist regime's electrical grid, shutting down power, thereby disabling its radar system. Israeli regime military officials urged people not to show footage of Iranian missiles hitting targets. Some social media users have dismissed these requests and uploaded video footage of the damage caused to Nevatim Air Base, where the U.S.-supplied F-35 are stationed. It was from this base that the Zionist regime had launched its attack on the Iranian consular section at its embassy in Damascus. Israel has not taken any journalists, not even Israeli or pro-Israeli Western reporters, to verify its claims that the Nevatim airbase suffered only minor damage. Beyond physical damage, two other factors are important. First, the psychological damage to Israelis as a result of this strike is enormous. Recently, millions of Israelis were cowering in bunkers amid air raid sirens. The financial cost to the Zionist regime is also enormous, estimated at over $1.35 billion. Second, and much more significantly, Iran was able to gather specific information about the location of Israeli defenses and their vulnerabilities. Iran will now be able to use this information for future operations. While the Israeli cabinet is weighing the options of attacking Iran, in his conversation with the Zionist regime Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, U.S. President Joe Biden made clear that if Israel carried out an attack against Iran, Washington would not be there to help. Instead, Biden announced that he would call a meeting of the G7 to consider a diplomatic response to Iran's retaliatory strikes against the Zionist regime. It must be borne in mind that American, British, and French air forces intercepted a number of drones before they hit targets in Israel. Jordanian territory was also used to launch anti-aircraft missiles. The artificial kingdom is a U.S. Zionist puppet. It will pay a heavy price for such treachery. The cowardly Arab rulers have also been put on notice. If they allow their airspace to Israel or allow their bases for the U.S. to attack Iran, there will be a price to pay. Regional dynamics have been radically altered.
Doing a sound from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Now, the skies over the Zionist-occupied territories were lit up by hundreds of Iranian drones and missiles late on Saturday night and early Sunday morning. Settlers ran for cover while natives looked up to the skies with hope, and people in the region celebrated the beginning of Iran's retaliatory strikes against the Israeli entity. Well, stay with us as we look at what it all means, Iran's retaliatory attack on the Zionist regime, and now what's likely to happen on this spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Out of Bethlehem, New York, former U.S. Marine Intelligence Officer Scott Ritter. Out of London, historian and author Shivan Mahendraraja. Well, thank you both for being with me. Let's start it off I'm going to start it off in London, actually, with Shivan. And the Israeli regime being an invincible power has been a narrative that the Western hegemonic front, along with the regime, has propagated for decades. And, of course, the resistance front has been destroying the narrative for years now, from Hezbollah to Hamas and now Iran, with its retaliatory strikes inside of the occupied territories. Your thoughts about how this has affected the Zionist regime, actually losing this narrative and understanding that it's definitely not invincible?
Well, thank you very much for having me here. I'm actually honored to also be with Scott Ritter on the show. So I actually think that this is really an eye-opener for Israelis, and I mean just ordinary Israelis as much as it is for the government, because this narrative of invincibility has been built up for many years, but also the younger generation has not experienced war. They have not had to go into air raid shelters, nor have to hear air raid warnings like their parents and grandparents did up through the Yom Kippur War. So this raid of something like 185 drones, some 110 ballistic missiles, they came in from different parts. So all of Israel was lit up with air raid warnings, about 750 air raid warnings, I believe. I could be wrong. But anyway, a lot of people were going into shelters. They were panicking even before this. And now that sense of security is gone, because this is actually a very successful raid. Now, there are people who are saying, oh, well, only about three or four missiles hit, everything else was shot down. Actually, no, because what they did was to overwhelm and to confuse the air defense systems of Israel, plus all the people who were helping Israel, Jordan, U.S., France, Britain, and the U.S., of course. And the targets were hit, what they wanted to strike. Some of the other missiles and drones were shot down, but it was at a huge cost, not just financial cost, but in terms of the interceptors that were used. They cannot keep doing this if they want to escalate with Iran, and Iran keeps launching wave after wave after wave, day after day. At some point, Israel is going to run out of missiles, because these things just can't be manufactured overnight, and there is a limited amount of stock, and the U.S. has to hold on to some of the stock that they have for their own purposes, as well as all the other things that they want to do in terms of, you know, a war with China, or in case NATO needs them. So anyway, I think this is quite successful. And it was what I call a reconnaissance in force, by the way, in the sense is that they use a fair amount of force, but not overwhelming force. And I think the Iranian IRGC aerospace learned a lot about Israel's air defenses from what happened yesterday, as to what can get through, what Israel can throw back up at them. So that if this escalates, there is a lot that they can use.
Okay, stay with me, Shivan. Sorry to interrupt. Let me get Scott in on this conversation. Well, Scott, I mean, your assessment of Iran being able to penetrate the Israeli airspace and several layers of its defense mechanisms.
Well, first of all, I want to echo everything that your guest Shivan just said. He's 100% correct. This was an extraordinarily successful attack by Iran on Israel. We need to understand, first of all, the objective of the attack. It was to prove a point that Iran could, in fact, strike Israel at a time and place of its choosing. Iran made a decision, I believe, in this attack to limit the scope and scale of the attack so as to not give Israel a reason to retaliate to the Iranian retaliation. The Iranians wanted to demonstrate a capability, put Israel and its allies, including the United States, on notice that Iran possesses a viable deterrence, and that Iran will strike those who strike Iran, and that the price that will be paid will be heavy, and therefore nations should think twice before attacking Iran. And I think that this objective was achieved. We see that by the United States pressuring Israel not to launch an attack, and Israel not pushing back very hard, because Israeli officers, you know, you talked about this narrative, this concept of Israeli invincibility. Israeli officers, and I've worked with them in the past, are very professional. They're very realistic, and they know what the truth is. They have, for the past 2 years, conducted war games where they exercise a scenario that has Israel being attacked simultaneously by Hezbollah, by Syria, by Iran. And a key aspect of their thinking going in, of the calculations they make, is the effectiveness of their air defense systems. And you have politicians in Israel who give high credence to Israeli air defense. And you have the military that's more balanced, more realistic. They know for certain now that their air defense will not stop an Iranian attack. That if Iran was to launch a full-scale attack, combined with Hezbollah, Syria, and others, that they would overwhelm Israeli air defense and inflict devastating, if not lethal, damage to the Israeli state. And so this is the impact. The Israelis now know for a fact that should they ever attack Iran, the consequences to Israel will be devastating. And this is the element of deterrence that Iran wanted to establish.
Okay. Well, speaking of that element of deterrence, Shivan, do you think in general that with Iran's attack on the Israeli regime, that there is now a different paradigm which has been established, and that the Israelis realize that they will have to answer, Tehran will make them answer, perhaps even incite the occupied territories for any type of aggression that they may initiate against Iran?
Yes. What has happened before is that since Iran was practicing strategic patience, there were many commentators and probably some, you know, in intelligence services and the military as well, who probably, you know, in Europe, U.S., Israel, who thought Iran was scared, that they were afraid to actually hit Iran, to hit Israel, but they would only use quote-unquote proxies to do the work for them. What happened today shows that Iran is more than willing to strike into Israel. And the announcement that the era of strategic patience is over is, I think, a very big announcement, because now what they are saying out of Tehran is basically, you hit us anywhere on our soil or in Syria, we will strike you at home. No more of this quote-unquote proxy business. And that, I think, should be a very, very strong lesson. But I think there's also the other factor which I would like to add in here, which also gets into the deterrence, is that now some of this information is very preliminary as to how many were launched, how many were shot down, what happened. But there is one good estimate out there that says that only about 50% of Iran's ballistic missiles were actually shot down. And this should scare not just the Israelis, but the Americans as well, because the systems used by the Israelis for the most part are American. Now think about what would happen if Israel does manage to create a regional war, which is what Netanyahu wants, which means the United States gets involved. Now, Israel has a very thick air defense blanket, But some of the American bases, certainly in Syria and in Iraq, but also in some of these other countries like Qatar, don't have that kind of air defense capability. And if Iran can get through to Israel's air defense, Israel's air defenses, they will be able to overwhelm American air defenses in Syria, Iraq, Qatar, UAE, and Kuwait. And that should scare the Americans into thinking, you know, Israel, don't do anything stupid.
Okay. Well, Scott, as you said earlier, Iran initiated a calculated and limited response against military sites. Now, why do you think that Iran gave a controlled response? And also, I'd like to look at the example that Iran is showing by not attacking civilian areas, but only military targets. I mean, much opposite of what, unfortunately, we have been witnessing the last 6.5 months in the genocide in Gaza.
Well, I think, first of all, we have to point out that Iran did not initiate the sequence of events that led to this, to the need for this action. That Iran is responding to irresponsible and illegal behavior on the part of Israel. Behavior that isn't just limited to the attack on the Iranian consulate in Damascus, but has extended to Israeli involvement in the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientists on Iranian soil, etc. Your other guest, Mr. Shervin, talked about Iran's policy of strategic patience, but it's more than that. Let's look at what Iran's been doing diplomatically in the last year or so. One, normalizing relations with Saudi Arabia. That's a very big step that shows that Iran is not posturing itself for regional confrontation, but rather regional stability. Iran has joined the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Iran has joined BRICS, which means that the Iranian focus is not on military aggression, but economic co-prosperity, economic cooperation. Iran has been struggling under international sanctions for decades now, and they are finally seeing a pathway to where they can look at normal economic relations with a good percentage of the world. Iran's not going to throw this away in an irresponsible military behavior. Iran is not looking for a fight. But Iran also can't stand by and allow Israel to carry out an attack of this nature, because left unpunished, Israel would just be more emboldened to do bigger and bigger acts. So Iran had no choice but to carry out an act of this nature. But this action was designed not to be decisive. I think people need to understand that. This was a deliberate act of constraint on the part of Iran, because they are not looking for a war. They are looking for peace. They are looking for stability, but they had no choice but to reestablish a policy, a posture of deterrence. And they've done that. It was a very calculated action on the part of Iran, both in terms of how they did this. What nation broadcasts the fact that they're going to attack another nation 5 hours in advance? And yet that's what Iran did, by sending out in a very publicized manner its loud Shahid drones. They told Israel, here we come. You have 5 hours to move your critical material away from stuff. Look at what they targeted. They didn't saturate an air base. They hit one or two runways. They hit some empty warehouses. They let Israel know that Iran can look at a point on a map and hit that point on the map. But they also let Israel know that Iran deliberately avoided the high-value targets, deliberately avoided the places where they could generate high numbers of casualties. Iran was not looking to punish Israel. Iran was simply looking to put Israel on notice that if Israel continues this behavior, Israel will be punished. But Iran is not looking for a fight. Iran is not looking for a war. Iran is looking for regional peace and prosperity that, you know, is engendered by stability, political stability, not the instability of conflict.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Right. Well, what about that, Shivan? You heard what Scott said, that Iran is not looking for a fight. But when we look at the reactions, whether we're talking about, well, you're in London, Rishi Sunak, and what he said, for example, after the Iran's retaliatory attacks, and saying that, again, the UK stands with Israel and condemned the Iranian attacks. And, of course, we saw the same thing coming from other various Western countries. Your thoughts on that? Because this continual scenario that this Western hegemonic front has tried to show as Iran basically being the bad guy, the terrorist, and of course then the Israelis being the defenders of democracy. I mean, do you think that we're transitioning, that more and more people understand that lie now?
I think so. I think, you know, what has happened over the last 6 months has changed a lot of minds all across the world. Even people who were formerly, you know, very pro-Israel have turned against Israel given what has happened. There are, for example, some very strong conservative voices like, I think, Candace Owens and Tucker Carlson, who have actually been critical. And I think the narrative is changing. People like Rishi Sunak and that EU person, von der Leyen, or whatever they call her. I mean, you know, people are just tired of them. I actually don't even read their tweets or their stuff because it's the same thing that's recycled. And I think this is true for millions of people around the world, that that they just see these Western leaders as hypocrites who talk about democracy, civil rights, civil liberties, human rights, but they don't actually exercise it. And I think these 6 months of Gaza has exposed that. So I don't know who listens to these people anymore, except those who are deeply devoted to one particular narrative and will not change their minds. I mean, you see lots of Jews. Like, you know, I was home in New York in October, and there were lots of Jews. I'm a New Yorker. I'm living here. But I saw lots of Jews out there protesting, you know, what was going on in Gaza. And this is really one of the things that the media do not want to talk about, is that the Jewish view of Israel is not monolithic. And you can see that in the major Western cities and capitals as well. So I don't know who Rishi Sunak is trying to convince, except, you know, like what we call preaching to the choir, maybe.
Right. Well, looking at this Western hegemonic front, Scott, we saw that last night during Iran's retaliation attack, that France, UK, US, Jordan were all involved in actually trying to shoot down Iranian drones. Your take on that? I mean, what does that say about the Israeli regime itself? Does it mean that it does not have the capacity to take on Iran at all or alone? Or and what does that do for their own self-confidence in being that they could not do this alone?
Well, first of all, we need to understand that Israel has war gamed out this scenario. And so they know the data, and they know what their saturation point is when it comes to their air defense ceasing to be effective against incoming targets. The other thing is the United States, France, Great Britain, they are part of this game of keeping Israel out of a broader war with Iran. And so it was in their interests to shoot down these targets. Iran wanted them to shoot down these targets. Iran sent overwhelming force that required the United States, Great Britain, France to put up their airplanes, to bring in their air defense, to come to the assistance of Israel, to mitigate the potential damage that could be done. And it was also a signal to all parties that Israel cannot stand alone. And therefore, it's in the interest of these parties to keep Israel out of a broader war, because in order to save Israel, they will have to be involved. But the same missiles that hit targets in Israel with precision accuracy can hit a British base in Cyprus. They can hit a French base. They can hit American installations in the Middle East. All of these nations now know that Iran has a capability that can hurt them in a time of conflict. And so this was sort of this act of grand theater where Iran and the United States, they wrote a script, because the United States did not want, the United States knew that Iran had to strike. They understood the political reasoning behind it. They didn't want Iran to launch an overwhelming attack, and they let Iran know that. And Iran, not wanting a broader war, replied by sending enough force to send a message, but not too much, so that the United States could write a script that had its aircraft, its ships coming to the assistance of Israel, demonstrating friendship, at the same time that Joe Biden picks up the phone, tells Benjamin Netanyahu that the United States will not participate in an attack against Israel. So we're friends under certain circumstances, but the friendship is not limitless. This is, again, part of the script that Iran was shaping. I think the Iranians deserve far more credit diplomatically as well, that this is not just a military victory. This is a diplomatic achievement of some note.
All right, and last question, Shivan. We only have like a minute of time, but there were videos being shown last night, Palestinians celebrating. Gazans are saying it was the first time that there was no buzzing of drones over their heads, and also Palestinians in the West Bank even approaching the, trying to tear down the apartheid wall. Let's talk in general about what could it mean. I mean, Iran has penetrated Israeli airspace, but if the Muslim countries were truly independent and united, what could that mean for the Palestinians?
Well, I think there was a great deal of cheering going on from Muslim countries. And I saw comments from Pakistanis. I actually tweeted something from the Taliban where they were actually praying for success.
Well, I'm mainly talking about the Muslim countries right on side of the Palestinian territories.
Oh, right. Oh, I'm sorry. I misunderstood.
Yeah, no problem.
Well, that's kind of difficult because, I mean, you know, their rulers are very much in terms on the side of the United States, and they will do what the United States wants them to do. So I'm not quite sure how much benefit there will be for the people, even though they will privately cheer, and I'm sure Jordanians and Lebanese and so and Saudis and so on may have been cheering for Iran, but how that will benefit the Palestinian people is very difficult, because governments are not going to be supporting the Palestinian people.
And on that note, I thank both of you for being with me. Scott Ritter, former U.S. Marine Intelligence Officer out of New York, Shivan Mahandaraja, historian and author out of London. And thank you for being with us on another Spotlight right here at Press TV. I'm Marzia Hashemi, signing out for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day, from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. Now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
An-Naqi means the pure, the immaculate, the clean. Al-Hadi means the guide. All the Imams came for guidance.
As-salamu alaykum ya ahla bayt al-nubuwa wa mawdha' al-risala wa mukhtalaf al-malaik.
Peace be upon the directors of right guidance, the lanterns in darkness, the patterns of piety.
This is Dialogue, an introduction into the most important dialogues and conversations of Imam Ali ibn Muhammad al-Hadi alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Imam Ali ibn Muhammad al-Hadi alayhi salam was the pure direct descendant of the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. He was the 10th divinely appointed successor. He was the 10th divinely appointed imam. He was the 10th divinely appointed trustee to the final Messenger of Allah, the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. A great number of Muslims believed in the imama of Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam, and they found it obligatory upon them to follow and obey Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam. A vast amount of legal dues and monies that must be given to the Imam were carried to Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam, as he was the financial epicenter of the Shia. And it was partly due to this financial leadership of Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam that governmental investigators and policemen reported in detail to the Abbasid Caliph al-Mutawakkil. And so al-Mutawakkil Abbasi was the most bitter enemy of not only the Alawis and the followers of Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam, but he was a bitter enemy of Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam himself. At this moment, we invite you to listen to parts of the Arabic text of Ziyarat Jamiatul Kabira by Imam Hadi alayhi salam, along with its English translation. Please stay tuned.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. As-salamu ala a'immatil huda wa masabih at-tuja wa a'lam at-tuqa wa dawin nuha.
In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Peace be upon the directors of right guidance, the lanterns in darkness, the patterns of piety, the owners of understanding, the endued with thoughts, the havens of the peoples, the inheritors of the prophets, the perfect specimen, the most excellent call in the arguments of Allah against the inhabitants of the world, the hereafter and the former world. Allah's mercy and blessings too be upon you all.
Welcome back. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So we're talking about the dialogue